Continued afterwards. Okay. So only one person replied to me about next week. And then I had, based on a lot of the responses today, I had an idea of a thing to do next week. It's going to be an intensive in-class exercise. So there's going to be no reading to do ahead of time. You know, there's nothing to prepare for. We'll just focus it all in the class. But what that means is, for those of you who haven't turned in paper number one, all the time you're not going to spend reading this week, finish writing. And for those of you who did turn in paper one, and I replied to everyone except for the two that sent them to me today, or yesterday, last night, I can't remember, everyone should have gotten them back. So if you think you sent it to me a while ago and you haven't gotten it back yet, let me know. I'll also be tomorrow, for those of you who have turned it in, and then for people who've turned it in since then, I'll give this other thing to you when I get your paper back, sort of tips for number two, because there's some common themes that have happened in more than one that I thought I could provide some general guidance for. And they basically have to do with finding that line between classic research paper and opinion piece. It's a fine line to bridge. So I have some ideas about that. And I'm going back and forth with some people with the track change comments, so that's fun. So if I've said anything that you're like, you didn't understand what I meant, you know, I'm writing things not just to say, you know, I'm usually not doing grammar things or organizational things. It's sort of questions or ideas to think about. So we can use that as a conversation if you want to. All right. And thank you to Bridget, was it you that posted that thing about that find the best?
The statistics.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I'd never seen that before.
I just Googled it because I wanted to know, like, the current. Yeah. That's
yeah. So I passed out some things because I got intrigued by it. Unfortunately, their charting isn't as good as it could be.
Yeah.
And then, so the first page, and what we can just sort of use these as references if we have hypotheses or things we want to look at. And then at the end of class, one of the latter slides is talking about problems with data and national versus local and that sort of thing. This first page is from just the CIA fact books. And there's actually a CIA fact book page on the United States, too. So what's interesting is that this little asterisk note for Zimbabwe, Uganda, Botswana, and South Africa, I did not add that note. That's in there. When you hit people in the fact book, and the first thing is population, note, estimates for this country explicitly take into account the effects of excess mortality due to AIDS. This can result in lower life expectancy, higher infant mortality, higher death rates, lower population growth rates, and changes in the distribution of population by age and sex than would otherwise be expected. So there's this. And the CIA fact book is kind of fun, particularly if you have experience in a country. Any in-depth experience to go see what the CIA says about that country. just random side note, it has a whole kids section with games. You know, you can collect your CIA badge, and I'm like, they're tracking IP addresses. I know they are, you know. Because first I thought, well, have fun, because Alejandro's got the spy kit. Somebody gave it to us. You know, he's got the little thing, he can look around corners, he's got his seat, he's like, has an ID badge that says, I'm a custodial worker. He's like, I'm going to go up to Daddy's office and clean it. And he came down with like a random post-it that Pedro had left on his desk. Look what I found. So, I don't know. Jonathan gave his intern talk today, and one of the things he talked about was conspiracy theories, which we'll be talking about again. What was interesting is, Jonathan, it was an intern talk. It wasn't, you know, among necessarily his peers, or sort of his future peers. But what was interesting, he spent some time on conspiracy theories. And do you notice how he ended, how he sort of summarized conspiracy theories?
No, I might have had to run up the money.
Oh, yeah, you might have, yeah. Called it lazy thinking.
Oh, yeah.
So. And I was like, okay, now's not the place for time. Because... I don't know if he actually thinks it's just lazy thinking. And I think, Anna, it was you who in your post talked about how you were surprised at how unsurprised you were about the sort of the believability and how the conspiracy theories about HIV and AIDS in Africa were to you. And I posted a reply. We'll talk about this in my fall class with urban health and a lot of urban bioethics issues, with a lot of the sort of underrepresented, you know, the victims of structural violence, unemployed, discriminated against, similar sorts of resistance to institutionalized healthcare and medicine. I don't know necessarily about conspiracy theories, for example, among the young urban black population in Philadelphia, but the idea that we talked about last week, that conspiracy theories reflect an underlying social pressure and frustration and vulnerability and sort of sense of risk and uncertainty, I think by far is not lazy thinking.
You said it was an oversimplified view of the world. It's just too simple.
Mm-hmm. Of course, he says he was dealing with people who tell him all the time that the CIA is controlling their brainwaves. So we'll talk about conspiracy theories again more today. And then the second two pages are from this findthebest.com. And it says it's a beta version, so I don't know if this is like a new product that's out or like a new service. But you could compare cars, education, electronics and computers, finance, health, reference, softwares. It didn't print the colors in the country code, but they go in order. South Africa's blue, Zimbabwe's red, we're yellow, Uganda's green, and Botswana is purple. I believe. I'm blue-green colorblind, so the first one's blue-ish. So these are as good as they are, and we'll talk about problems with data later. So if we want to call on evidence to talk about our theories. Okay, so putting HIV/AIDS, and we focused this week, with three articles from Africa, but HIV/AIDS and global bioethics. I think there's some key issues that are applicable sort of no matter where we're looking. There's the question of prevention versus treatment, which we've gotten from as soon as we started reading Paul Farmer's weeks ago. Cost and access issues, sort of the ethics and applicability of top-down interventions versus more vertical intervention efforts. Whoops, horizontal. Okay, up side to side. And then in a global bioethics from an anthropological perspective, one of the things I'm particularly interested in this week is the strong relationship between sexual beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors, or beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors around sex and procreation, gender, femininity, masculinity, and culture. And then questions of vulnerability and social justice. I'm sure there are many more, but these are the five that bubble to the top for me. So the articles this week are giving us some ethnographic data, in-depth, on-the-ground, thick description, to try to reveal in some ways the local and the particular. Because what we have here, in the fact books and the statistics, are really generalized statistical epidemiological type of data, which many of you pointed out in your posts. There's so much that's subsumed under that percentage number. There's rural, there's urban, there's rates of urbanization, there's migration numbers. So we have sort of three thick descriptions. And what I think they all do is, and particularly well, I think, is tie intervention efforts as they're existing on the ground in local places to not only the local context, but also the global context as well. And I think those, in this week, we're really, we've been introducing and slowly refining our themes over the course of the semester. I think many of them really come to a head in this week and in these readings. Some commonalities that all the articles point to, and I'm not going to say all AIDS interventions in Africa or anywhere, but for this week, they all place an emphasis on the impact and the effects of colonization, rapid urbanization, and industrialization. And how the changes that are brought about by fundamentally altering long-standing and traditional means of subsistence, distributions of labor, local hierarchies, sort of authority, changing that and changing the economic conditions leads to changes in sexual behavior. And then it's the changes in sexual behavior that leads to increased vulnerability to disease. And I like that expression too, vulnerability to disease, because it sort of walks that line that the articles talk about when people are trying to figure out HIV and AIDS. To what extent is the victim or the sufferer or the patient themselves responsible for what happened to them? They all talk about gender as a key variable. Again, they all talk about the interaction of the local with the global, the West. They all, some less, some more, talk about conspiracy theories and explanatory models. Because really, a conspiracy theory is just an explanatory model. And ambiguous positions on condom use and advocacy. So as we go through and talk about the articles, we'll talk about all of these things, and then we're going to separate out at the end the question that a lot of people talked about in their posts this week, the question of political and governmental control and the spectrum between free will and free choice with government suggested interventions and more forceful behavior modifications and literally social control with a stick, not just with carrots, to change behavior. And we'll talk then also about data. So that's where we're going. So this is commonalities in terms of factors that are addressed in the articles. They also have commonalities in terms of the perspective they're taking, their more theoretical orientation towards the problem of HIV and AIDS and public health interventions. Taylor's article, which I don't think anybody talked about in the postings, perhaps because you thought it was long. It was the best of the bunch, I think. It's got lots of pictures. And the pictures don't really have, they're just pictures of the place. You know, so you're sort of trying to figure out what does the picture have to do with anything. It really, if you didn't read it, since we don't have any readings for next week, go back and read it. It's really good. I'm blanking on the exact title right now, but it's A Place of Trouble, The Political Ecology of HIV AIDS in Chipinge, Zimbabwe. I even wrote a great article on the front with an exclamation point. And a lot of the things I'll be talking about will be coming from, and we're talking about her first. Who is she? She was a postdoc fellow at the HIV Center at Columbia in New York. She describes her orientation as a critical interpretive approach to medical anthropology, in which she looks at lived experiences in conjunction with broader structural inequities that influence vulnerability. At this point, I hope, but if it's not 100% in this room, I'm okay with that. We'll work on it some more. I said very similar things to this at the first class. By now, hopefully, you should read this and go, right. I understand. You may not agree. You may not think, you know, broader structural inequities. You might be on this sort of, it's behavior camp, it's beliefs, it's, you know, it's the more theoretical, less tangible aspects of people's lives that make a difference. So you may not agree with it, but I think we all understand this now. Checking people's faces. Okay. If not, send me an email, because this stuff is key right here. The articles also all share a concern with social justice. Notions of solidarity and special protections for particularly vulnerable people. They also do, I think, a very good job of talking about how biology and culture are intimately intertwined. Taylor cites a book by Goodman and Leatherman, which I printed out. They have it at the library here, and I want to read it. What's the name of the article, or their book? Spatial Vulnerability and Poverty and Health. There's another one, I don't know what it is. Citing Goodman and Leatherman, it says, what we're looking at here is a matrix in which sociocultural, political, economic processes affect human biologies, and then how compromised biologies further threaten the social fabric. So it's really sort of, this is one of the central cruxes of global public health, is the fact that you've got a social situation that makes people more vulnerable to disease. They get debilitating diseases, which then circles back and further disrupts the social fabric, which makes more people vulnerable, makes it harder to treat, and it's a vicious cycle. Because it has such a wide effect, because it is this cyclical process that feeds upon itself in many ways, then it doesn't just affect the body, it doesn't just affect the household, it doesn't just affect personal relationships, it doesn't just affect the economics of a town, it doesn't just affect relationships among groups between the town, it doesn't just affect how people consider their own local in relation to the global, it affects all of those things. Which, since we've been talking about what is the definition of culture, culture is all of those things. Culture is your relationship to your own body, to your family, to your friends, to your community, to your means of production, to the politics around you, to the history, to the economics. So if something like HIV/AIDS in places where it is such a, people call it, it is a disaster, and if it's having such an effect such as in point three, it by necessity is having an, you could think of it as bringing about not just a crisis of physical health, but a crisis of meaning. Does that make sense with how we get from biology and culture being intertwined in that cyclical process that Goodman and Leatherman note to it being a crisis of meaning? What does it mean for something to be a crisis of meaning? How can we flesh that out in our own words?
It's a radical shift or something new that hasn't been culturally dealt with, and that causes people to need to, it's a need to address this new thing or this shift.
Mm-hmm.
It's a need to address and come up with new ways of explaining, new ways of interpreting this thing.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, Kleinman talks about. It's what some of the authors mentioned. Evans Pritchard, who was a famous Evans Pritchard, I believe, talking about witchcraft, you know, and as an explanatory model. You know, people understand the biology and the physics of things. The classic example being, you know, two guys were sitting, you know, under an awning, and the awning collapsed. They understood that it was termites that had eaten the wood that caused the awning to collapse. That's an explanation, but it's not really an explanatory model to answer the question, why was that particular person under the awning at that time? So, yes, even when there is the biological understanding of a disease process, we see this here with cancer. In the United, we can see it around ourselves in the United States. Even when there is the what we would consider the correct biomedical understanding, there's any illness leads to a crisis of meaning if it's severe enough and it impacts a life enough, if it's disruptive. The level of disruption with HIV/AIDS in certain communities elevates that crisis of meaning, not just from not not just from an individualized perspective, but from a community perspective, which is why we see things like political battles over HIV intervention, why we see things like conspiracy theories. So I want to start by talking more about what Taylor calls the political ecology of HIV/AIDS. She notes that what she's trying to do here is expand the traditional, when people look at sort of the basis of disease, they look at the interaction between the pathogen, the host, and the environment. She wants to expand that to include non-biological bases of disease. You know, Katrina, you talked about this in your blog post. You know, what are the important factors? Historical factors, sociocultural factors, political factors, economic factors. The pathogen host environment isn't enough. And she says that if you're looking at vulnerability to HIV infection, all of those variables play a role in the level of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that those variables are not actually being taken into account, though? I mean, I'm just curious. I don't know.
By whom?
By people in large, do you think this is like a science? Like, do you think science doesn't take them into account? Like, the people that are coming up with treatments and and policies, do you think it's, who isn't taking them into account is my question. If they're not being taken into account.
Well, I think they are, but I think trying to say is that, you know, you've got a lot of bench scientists and science geeks who are looking at the problem at a very micro level. You know, it's the same way that when we seek solutions for things, you know, we seek them in the genes. Mm-hmm. You know, how can we adapt this? You know, now sort of talking about Jonathan, you know, we're seeking it in the brain. Mm-hmm. What does neurology tell us about how to solve, you know, like behavioral problems, for example? But there's really no integrated field that can manage the translation between the bench guys and the more social scientists, global health, public health type people.
Mm-hmm. I forget if I was reading this in an article for the class or for my specific paper, but I had heard somebody critique the idea of expanding it, notions of disease to include historical and sociocultural variables and whatnot by saying, well, part of the value of not including those is that it makes it more broadly applicable, and that if you use this kind of interpretation, anytime you have a sociocultural shift, then you have to come up with a new name for the disease or a new way of treating the disease, or it loses some of its universality or its applicability.
What was your reaction to that argument?
I think it's looking at it a bit short-sighted. I mean, you probably don't have to call it something else every time there's a sociocultural shift. And maybe the whole point of this is that, yeah, the fact that there is a sociocultural shift means that you ought to think about how that sociocultural shift changes your ideas of treatment or things like that. Mm-hmm.
I don't know, what do you guys think?
Well, I'm not sure if this is a really good response or not, but maybe it's difficult to include the non-biological factors in terms of how to treat a problem, just medically speaking, but if you're trying to control a problem more in terms of a culture, like whether they accept the treatment or not, for example, then that's when you would bring in the non-biological or non-biomedical factors, because that's when it does change from location to location.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't think that was in the articles that I've assigned. That doesn't sound familiar. I wonder who wrote it, and my guess would probably be it was a medical scientist.
I think it was.
Yeah.
I think he was thinking more about the psychiatry of it and saying, well, if you change it, then we have to come up with a whole different name for it, and, you know, it changes the field. So maybe he was looking at it too much from a biomedical perspective.
They often do that because they don't understand what it means when we talk about culture. It's the same reason they get upset when you mention the words cultural competency to somebody. my favorite quote from a physician was, "I don't need to know how to sing Kumbaya in Norwegian to treat my patients." No one's asking you to do that, you know. And if you think about it, I mean, look at how, and again, this is slightly changing. I think with the differences in now in how they're admitting people to med schools, how they're training practitioners of all ilks. But the way we, as a culture, learn medicine and understand medicine is microscopically, through x-rays, through diagnostic technologies, through testing, through genes. We don't focus in how we enculturate practitioners to whole people. We enculturate them to body parts or disease pathways. It's, you know, the way that medical education is systematized. You know, see one, do one, teach one. You need the ideal type if you're going to see one, do one, teach one. But I think we're slowly getting better about see how to figure one out, teach how to figure one out. Do a whole bunch of complicated ones. You know, I mean, it doesn't roll off the tongue quite as nicely. That responses like that strike me as, in some ways, paternalistic as well. You know, it's sort of like, these people don't understand what we're trying to do. We've got the solution. If they would just sort of accept the biomedical model and do it, we'd all be fine. But all these damn cultural shifts keep getting in the way. You know, it's sort of like a petty annoyance. It's noise in the data, as opposed to what I think the anthropological perspective gives us, which is, it's not noise. It's the fundamental building blocks, and we're constantly renovating our houses. Did I address your, yes. Probably more than you asked for. Okay. But if you can find that article, if you stumble upon it, send it to me.
I'll look at it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, so political ecology. Some of the other things that she talks about, that if we take this perspective, if we're expanding, you know, to include all of these variables in understanding disease, when we look at people's behavior in the face of disease, we shouldn't be focusing just on beliefs and free will, but as she says, decisions made by actors operating under a set of constraints. And this struck me as exactly what Frances was talking about a few weeks ago when she suggested that we replace autonomy with the notion of agency. So just to break this down a little bit further, you know, she's, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, you know, moving beyond the reduction that comes in a lot of global health that gives us broad risk groups, Haitians, to look more specifically at human agency and the social forces influencing ability to act, and she focuses on structural violence on both a local and global level. And she does this through the case of Chipinge in Zimbabwe. The full name of the town, Chipingampingi, translates, she says, to a place of trouble. It was originally described as a place of trouble because it was characterized by a lot of sort of witchcraft accusations and witchcraft beliefs. But she says it's been transformed to the, however, today it more accurately describes the trauma of everyday life caused by the high incidence of HIV/AIDS. This area is a highly fertile zone, desirable, you know, which means, you know, it was desirable for the colonizers, it was desirable for the large commercial farmers. It's characterized by sort of good natural resources, but stricter control by large corporations. The people, other than the big companies, are politically and economically marginalized, and it suffered from poorly executed land repatriation. When Zimbabwe became Zimbabwe, gained its independence, apparently there was a deal that they wouldn't do any land redistribution until 10 years post-independence. And so after 10 years hit, it was done like that. I mean, Dan, you're probably sort of familiar with sort of how land repatriation has been done in and around parts of Venezuela. Same sort of thing.
Certainly.
And unemployment skyrocketed. It wasn't planned, so there wasn't enough sort of cropland for full profit. There might have been sustainability, but not sort of for profit. Big mess in this town. So it's had years of struggle. She calls it a national disaster. In 2005, when she was there, AIDS was causing 3,000 deaths a week. She describes it in terms of the epidemic in this area. In the early years, it was people who contracted HIV were the more educated, more wealthy, people able to travel. They were more mobile. And that shifted over time to younger, poorer, and women. So that now the highest risk groups, again, focusing on this idea of travel and migration, are military, truck drivers, migrant laborers, business travelers, refugees, prisoners, and commercial sex workers. And a lot of this mobility, in terms of the migrant laborers, the refugees, the prisoners, you know, sort of this cycle, tracing it back, you know, structural adjustments, economic changes, military changes, how economic and politics ends up affecting health in a very profound way. She cites the Zimbabwe's National AIDS Council saying that what is contributing to this national disaster and this AIDS epidemic in Zimbabwe are poverty, low economic and social status of women, prevalence of other STDs, multiple sexual relationships, inconsistent use of condoms, complexity of settlement patterns and mobility, forced labor migration, and low levels of male circumcision. Based on what you know now about an anthropological perspective, a more critical medical anthropology, is there anything in here that you would add to say what are some other contributing factors to AIDS epidemics? And you can sort of generalize through all the articles. If you didn't read this article, think of the ones you did read for this week, because they share a lot of the same factors.
Well, I mean, this sort of is part of the inconsistent use of condoms, but I think it was the article comparing Uganda and what was the name?
Botswana.
Right. Just about like the different beliefs about what condom use meant in terms of the disease. So some people thought that it caused it rather than helped prevent it. So I know this might sound paternalistic a little bit, but just the comprehension of intervention efforts. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like if people do understand that it's to help and not harm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So a contributing factor, sort of to throw something into that paragraph, would be inconsistent or poorly thought out intervention efforts?
Yeah.
Non-culturally sensitive or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
I think I might add the words educational access. I guess with multiple implications, because I'm thinking about the Uganda effort with the government being involved in a helpful way. But also just in terms of more general statistics regarding education and impoverished women, that mm-hmm. one of the ways to bring people up is to expand education to women, to girls, to female women.
Okay. Sure. Yeah, Matt.
It's kind of like my response to the, or at least my response to the posting that I put, but this reminds me of the Mother Clean example of how it's not just education, it's like effective education, like to do it well, to see that it's working. Mm-hmm. I mean, the example is that the ABC method didn't really work because people didn't really appreciate being told to condomize. It was the fact that, you know, they once it's on their level, they could relate to not grazing, and that get that's education right there, you know.
So culturally competent. Well, let's just for now we'll just call it culturally competent interventions. Okay. Yeah, Anna.
I guess lack of consistent, I guess this is going back to the Allen, and it's pronounced heel. I'm not sure about the last name, sorry, I was just asking for you.
Yeah, held.
Okay, article that they mentioned, the need for consistent HIV testing with an opt-out policy as opposed to an opt-in.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that they would be, you know, that it would be made available to them and they would be able to opt out if they want to opt out, so it would still be voluntary as opposed to they have to proactively opt in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to go somewhere else. I thought you were going to go with... No, I mean... the fact that if there's inconsistent testing, you can't target your intervention efforts. You know, so you can't really track and target. I was just thinking one step...
Beyond.
Or below, actually.
Oh.
To the left.
Horizontal.
To the right, yeah.
Just bridging it with Shauna. I like it.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about carrots and sticks in a little bit. Right, so I mean, there's a lot of other factors, and I think we've touched on some of them, and mirroring what Taylor talks about. In fact, she talks about micro-sociological and macro. And on the micro level, she talks about the symbolic terrain of sexual culture, which is where you get into things like, well, what would the meaning of a condom be in a particular cultural setting? In Zimbabwe, or at least in this region where she was working, high symbolic value on sex and procreation. It promotes lineage survival, and it gives status. So for men, it's evidence of virility, and for women, it can elevate their status in family and community. And I have no ethnographic personal experience, so I just have to take her by her word. You know, she says that not being married or not having children is in many ways a form of social and economic death. Or at least ostracization. Which, as we'll see as we get through her example of Sake, which is her sort of case study, it does sort of lead to death, because if you don't have the social interactions or the economic help, there's no other options. And I'm glad that she does this. She mentions it and then she leaves it aside. Because a lot of times when they talk about why is there such a prevalence of HIV in different parts of Africa, they'll point to things like the virgin cleaning myth. They'll say, it's because a whole bunch of men are having sex with virgins because they believe that it will clear them up of their STDs. She says, other than the practice of having multiple, either official wives, or she calls it neo-polygyny, which is having sort of one official wife and then having multiple common law-ish sort of wives, which they have to do now because they can't afford bride prices anymore and it's just too expensive, but you still maintain benefits. These don't have a lot to do with the epidemic of HIV/AIDS. So we will do what she does and we will push them aside. Because they're obviously the more sexy topics, because they're so, in your face, different. So we've got sort of the idea of what is, the procreation and the status of having children on a micro level. And then she switches to the macro level. And she does this through her example of one woman, Sake. She says her story tells the story of poverty, gender inequality, sexual culture, labor migration, and the problem of concurrent sexually transmitted infections on the one hand. And it also shows, as this woman tries to navigate society, her community and the healthcare system, the consequences of fear and stigma and the consequences of a broken down healthcare infrastructure. So her story is a story of childhood neglect, economic survival, and discrimination. And as she says in the beginning, if we want to look at not just the pathogen and the host and sort of the physical environment, sort of being malnourished, having the multiple STDs or STIs at the same time, her story shows the social, political, and economic that should start to roll off your tongue by the end of this class. Social, political, economic, historical. She was 29 years old when the author knew her. She says her life started and ended with violence. She was a child of rape, which meant she was shunned by her family from a very early age, which means she was not given the same educational opportunities as her siblings. She was just sent to go watch the cattle. That was her job. She was sort of ignored, didn't get as much food, you know, just all of the things you could imagine what is involved by being shunned by your family. As an age when she could start working, she worked as a maid until she discovered she could make more money in sex work. And that's a great story here, interwoven in this article, is, you know, every time I read or see the words IMF and World Bank in an article and structural adjustments, I just sort of go, oh, they never end well. They never end well because they're so short-sighted and focused just on the sort of getting the budget lines to line up, that they don't realize how these things trickle down and then create worse problems. And if anybody here is sort of more economically minded, you know, the fact that the U.S. right now is facing this debt ceiling crisis and the debt crisis, you know, is anybody sort of saying, theoretically, why don't we put the United States on a structural adjustment plan? It's fascinating for me to think about. Her story, like I said, also, these are the things that the story shows. So I want to look more specifically at poverty and then gender inequity. She shows through this story the range of the economic impact of HIV/AIDS. We know there's a direct loss of income from the infected if they can't work. But, you know, there's also the increase in household expenditures for treatment, drugs, and funeral expenses. And there's the indirect costs of not being able to work while you are taking care of the sick person. As you have more and more people who are leaving the active workforce, and again, remember, this is a region that is highly agricultural, you've got lower agricultural outputs, which means you can no longer have enough people to do the labor-intensive cash crops. Now you're doing labor-extensive subsistence crops, which leads to loss of crop diversification, which leads to drops in nutritional status, which turns around and then impacts how people respond to the pathogens in their environment and their increased vulnerability. And as she says, it pushes households from seasonal poverty, which is very common in agricultural-based societies. There's peaks and valleys in agricultural production. There's always seasonal poverty. But it pushes it from seasonal poverty to chronic poverty, because you no longer have your cash crops that enables you to have enough cash to buy the food you need when you're not producing it yourself. So I found myself, as I was reading this story, just literally, I sort of had the physical sensation of, like, when you let out a drain, and you just sort of keep spiraling, and you're going down, 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 and you know there's no way to get up. It just keeps getting worse and keeps getting worse. And then as a woman, as a feminist, you get to the gender inequality, and then you're just down the drain completely. The author says that it's next to gender inequality next to poverty is the most pronounced issue enhancing vulnerability. At the time that she wrote this, two-thirds of people in Zimbabwe with HIV/AIDS were women. Women get more infections, and they get their infections earlier. The community that she worked with, and a larger range of the area, when the colonial government, it was a very patriarchal society, and then when the colonial government came in, they sort of institutionalized that very hierarchical patriarchy by what they do. They legally made women minors to their fathers or their husbands in the law. So women had no independent economic opportunities. You know, they couldn't make financial decisions. It was a very hierarchical, patriarchal system. In 1980, there was the Legal Age of Majority Act, which took being a legal minor, took gender out of the question and just made it age, which gives in principle equity, but in practice not.
Can I ask just a quick question?
Mm-hmm.
This is probably a nuisance detail question, but I was just wondering, like, about women who were widowed, like, what mm-hmm. their status would be. Like, because if their fathers were deceased, their husbands were deceased,
mm-hmm.
they wouldn't be classified as minors still, or could they, and to whom?
I don't know about the case in Zimbabwe, but I know a lot of cultures in which you are allowed to be polyandrous, one mm-hmm. male, multiple females. Mm-hmm. Sometimes what would happen is if husband dies, wife goes with brother. Because,
okay.
Yeah, father's dead. Yeah, there isn't a category of independent, non male affiliated woman.
So, okay, yeah, that's it. They have to have a male affiliated.
I don't want to say that with 100% authority because I'm not sure in this case, but in general, that's what sort of the anthropological literature shows, is that women will get passed around.
Mm-hmm. You know, there was a footnote in the article that said that widows can opt out of that inherited wife status.
Mm.
But I don't think that answers your question because I don't know what happened.
Right, what that means.
Yeah, like what, I don't know. It said that it was an advantage to them to be inherited because it gave them economic security.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it would imply that to not do that would mm-hmm. make them sort of fend for themselves.
You could always take another husband, perhaps, if the society allowed that.
Mm-hmm. I just ask, cause, like, I guess from a different type of anthropology and literature, that I'm like, you know, I guess like 17th century England and like Western Europe, that was like a pretty decent status to be if you were a widow and your father was also deceased.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if any type of equivalent could have existed
mm-hmm.
in this context.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much though.
And it probably didn't exist for poor Europeans.
Yeah.
Okay, the gender relations on the ground, very patriarchal, Taylor argues, minimizes women's ability to protect themselves against sexually transmitted diseases. It's a society in which sexual norms prevent frank talk about sex lives. I mean, I think that's probably, I don't want to say universal, but every culture, I mean, I don't know if there's any culture that's completely open about partners talking about sex lives. Although in the United States, we're so puritanical, first date, you get people a little bit drunk, and that's just the first thing they start talking about. You know, but it has to be like a first date drunk sort of conversation. It's a situation, she says, from her ethnographic fieldwork, that women fear requiring condoms or refusing sex should they fear their husbands are infected with STD, that it's sort of culturally accepted that that could be grounds for abuse, rape, or divorce. The vulnerability of women and the lack of, I'll say, agency, not necessarily autonomy, we'll go with agency, are factors that, as she says, minimize their ability to protect themselves. Yes.
The interesting take on that the Nyhaus and Janssen article mentioned was how some women actually feel compelled, or how women feel compelled to have sex without a condom so that they can keep their husband.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised that, you know, it turns around to them actually like offering that as a mm-hmm. bartering chip to keep them around.
Mm-hmm. Or evidence of trust, evidence of, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
Sure.
This is what you want. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We see that with young women in the United States, too.
Sure.
Disadvantaged young women.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a key part of this, also. Because a lot of times you'll read things about HIV and AIDS, and women are blamed. It's the promiscuity of women. She, through Sakai's story, shows that when you have such inequality in the socioeconomic realm, sex work becomes a good choice when you're sort of immediate risk benefits in terms of ability to support a family, just having enough financial security that you are literally not starving. And this, the system of multiple wives or multiple sex partners, says, it makes it very clear, it's not prostitution. She calls it sexual networking. Pointing out that in situations of extreme stress, of extreme poverty, of extreme inequality, for both men and women, sex becomes a tool to negotiate social relationships. And social relationships aren't just like, oh, I get together with my friends because I have a good time. No, it's social networking, social relationships, which provide access to education, access to food, access to a home. That it's on a more fundamental level. It's a strategy for economic survival. One of the other articles talks about this as well. So, in addition to all of that, in addition to poverty and gender, high levels of gender inequality, you also have simultaneously a breakdown of social services, public health services, and a highly migratory population. That's a dangerous position to be in, because breakdown, healthcare delivery is breaking down, it's collapsing under the pressure, and there's a medication shortage. In addition, she describes the social responses to HIV/AIDS as what she calls this AIDS, it's not her term, it's someone else's, AIDS scare syndrome. That in this setting, and this article is 2007, so she was there in 2005, you know, 4 or 5, that the responses to HIV/AIDS were characterized by fear, hysteria, violence, fatalism, sort of denial of personal risk, mistreatment of HIV/AIDS patients by healthcare workers, as well as xenophobia and international discrimination. So, that's where she ends. She says, here's a case study and sort of a lesson for Southern Africa that in order to understand and address HIV/AIDS, you need to observe the effects of poverty and socio-political insecurity on individuals and families, as well as the societal consequences of fear, stigma, and discrimination, how those things have created barriers to basic care. And she just repeats her claim that the biology and culture are dialectically intertwined. Okay, so this sort of, if we're looking at sort of a triangle of things that all the three different articles offer us, they're sort of one. I would like to move on to the gendered article, the Niehausen Johnson. But does anybody? I don't think anybody read this one. So this one, you did?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I guess maybe just no one liked it as much as I did. I was really surprised you didn't like it. Mm-mm. How come?
I don't know. I guess this is a problem I have with a lot of these. I feel like it's like saying, like pointing out the things that are wrong and being like, okay, yeah, these are things we need to account for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important. But I think because these are larger like systematic problems, like pointing them out doesn't really do a lot of good. So it's good to know that these mm-hmm. are the problems, but I think there are plenty of people that are involved in policymaking that are aware that these are problems, but
mm-hmm.
there isn't an easy way to address it. So I'm like, okay, that's great. We have another paper saying mm-hmm. that this is the problem.
Okay. You're going to really like next week then. And I mean that not sarcastically.
Okay.
Actually, I mean you really okay. will.
Yeah, well, I thought it was more effective for me, at least because it was personalized with mm-hmm. the cicada example. I mean, you go in and I think just... it's natural for us to root for the protagonist in the story, and you know it's not going to have a happy ending. And
mm-hmm.
I thought it was especially moving, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And her personal example, too, like, you know, from her upbringing through her death is just tragic.
Mm-hmm.
But illustrative, too, and the kind of discrimination she faced, especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think I see both of your points, Jane. I see the frustration with... you're right. So what do we now do? Which is why I say you're going to like next week. But I think there's so... part of my problem with when we start to have interventions is that this just, we say, oh, it's illustrative, it's interesting, but we don't take the lessons from it.
Yeah.
So I think the personalization and the having to continue to retell the story, also, by looking at these different contexts, tells us, all right, where are we finding differences, and what are those differences, what can we trace them back to? So that when we do design interventions, we're not just focused on the differences on the ground, but we're looking at, well, what did they trace back to? So it's that middle ground between national eye and, you know, local, yeah, microscopic, that we can find that middle ground, and that's where I think we're going to find the most success. So I think we need to have to keep having both of these. And, you know, they're also, I think, just good for, I think they do a better job of sticking in people, that you remember this kind of article more than some of the broader, less thick descriptions. Okay. All right. Where are we? Ah, gender. Okay. This article, Dr. Wouter Basson, Americans and Wild Beasts, Men's Conspiracy Theories of HIV/AIDS in the South African Lowveld. They're the ones that start out by saying it provokes a crisis of meaning. And they extend the crisis to an epidemic of signification. I think it's a little bit hyperbolic, but I liked it. Their main point is that you can't just address women's oppression, which a lot of intervention efforts do. You have to also pay attention to men's gendered concerns. That the problem is not just that women are being oppressed and don't have access to education or economic opportunities, they don't feel empowered to use condoms, but there's something going on that men are not just the sort of neutral other in which we're sort of contrasting women. There is no neutral other. There's two distinct realms of concerns here. In this case, in South Africa, some of the key factors that aren't present in Zimbabwe, or even in, to different extents, the other article, sort of an interesting history of government denials. And this might be, if you're interested in the relationship between national governments and HIV intervention efforts, for your last paper, sort of doing a sort of critical history of how governments respond, or a particular, don't just do plural because that would, impossible, a particular government is responding to, and at this point you start with the Wikipedia page, you know, you don't need to do in-depth research, because what I want is the critical. The Wikipedia is going to give you the facts. You don't need to question those anymore. I think we've gone to the point where, not that I want you to cite Wikipedia in your paper, but and then your critical input would be, well, what else is going on globally? What else is, what sort of external pressures are being exerted on this government? What internal pressures? So South Africa, history of government denials, we'll leave it at that. And perhaps because of this, in both of their field works, experiences, they found intense speculation about origins and transmissions, which makes sense. If you're denying it, or denying that HIV actually causes AIDS, of course then people are going to be looking for alternative explanations. They describe it as a cosmological problem, and their data is coming from 35 interviews with men, supplanted with 35 interviews with women on their sexual biographies. The key findings that are of interest here, and again, a lot of these articles are debunking myths, like the sexually promiscuous women being responsible for HIV. A lot of times people say, well, it's because they're ignorant and they talk about witchcraft. No. People in these communities did have in common witchcraft beliefs, but very distinct from how they understood HIV/AIDS. Makes sense that when HIV/AIDS comes along, it gets interwoven into an indigenous understanding of diseases that come about with sexual transgressions of sexual taboos. Two men having sex with one woman, that causes a mixing of blood, the belief that incest would cause the women to give birth to crippled babies, having sex with widows and sex during funerals can lead to a sort of coughing sickness. So the interesting implication is that when you throw HIV/AIDS in there, knowledge that it's a sexually transmitted disease, it made sense that it would fit, you know, again, with it, there's something happening with the transgression. And when you talk about it in that way, they said the implication is that it invests sufferers with some measure of choice responsibility. It's not, you know, HIV being caused by random willy-nilly accusations of witchcraft because of other sort of social deviations. So I think they throw that in there really because if you look in general at a lot of the AIDS in Africa literature, witchcraft is brought up a lot. In fact, the first time I taught this course in 2006, it was zombies, witches, and westerners. and we read a horrible ethnography, which I will never assign ever again about witchcraft. So they've debunked that. So I said, all right, well, if it's not because of witchcraft, you know, these origin stories and sort of the stories of how individuals come to have HIV/AIDS, talk about the gendered concerns, the origin stories, sort of women are to men as the local is to the global. And the origin stories, again, on both an individual level and a societal level, they say reflect sort of the persecutorial, that there's a misfortune. There's, again, poverty, inequity, vulnerability, injustice that bring out social tensions, and that the views of misfortune that come from this sort of socially tense environment, HIV/AIDS sort of falls into that mix and is made sense of. Which is another reason why I don't think, you know, that the article or the, whatever author you mentioned that said every time there's a social shift, you'd have to come up with a whole other new thing. No. You know, things get integrated into the fabric of society relatively easily. There's categories for things, and things can fall into categories. It's very rare that something is so new or so disruptive that there's not a prior category for it. Similar story here. Change in economy, reliance on migrant male laborers for financial resources. This area was a reserved exclusively for Africans. You know, so we've got to talk about this sort of apartheid history here too. And all features of a native reserve. Things we see in the United States with the Native American population. Broken homes, conjugal separations, escalating, I don't know about witchcraft accusations here, but high unemployment, violence, and suicide. Another problem of addressing HIV/AIDS in this community is, again, like Farmer has said, NGO and other involvements have really just focused on prevention, focused on safe sex, which leaves victims to suffer in silence. And when you've got victims suffering in silence, you know, you have to address current HIV patients or people because they're primary vectors in the disease transmission. So if you're going to focus on prevention, you got to focus on where it's emanating from. And a lot of these organizations that she describes here are not. Yes?
Well, didn't they talk about it in this from the ARB and how that didn't work because of other factors? I mean, so if you're looking at treatment mm-hmm. as well as prevention, that's not, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was just saying, never mind. Saying that, you know, they also have to look at not just prevention but treatment, that doesn't always work. I thought that was the kind of the gist of this paper.
Right, because there's barriers to providing treatment as well. Exactly. In fact, one of these talks about how GlaxoSmithKline and somebody else, Merck/Pfizer, mm-hmm. sort of created VIV, V-I-I-V, to do a sort of a, I don't want to say non-profit, but pharmaceutical company just to address these issues. But again, you've still got
everything else.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to leave all very depressed today, and we will build this ourselves up tomorrow, hopefully. Or not tomorrow, next week. So if you're looking at gendered understandings of HIV/AIDS, they talk about an economy of sex. That females are more likely to be single and without other sources of income. Male HIV positive people are more likely to be the wealthier of the poor and more likely to be married. Multiple sexual partners and diverse sexual relationships. Again, not prostitution, but money redistributions toward extremely poor women. It's an adaptive response to extreme poverty. Maladaptive, perhaps, but it's redistributing money so that poor people can eat, to put it bluntly. So in this economy of sex and gender distributions or gendered understandings, women's perspectives, you've got more acceptance and belief in the biomedical explanations. Women more oriented toward the value of school, the church, gender equality, monogamous marriage, and value of biomedicine and biomedical interventions. And a higher knowledge of HIV/AIDS transmission. I think there was one or two consistent misconceptions that they identified, but in general, their understandings were meshed with the biomedical model. These women wanted more education sooner, and they had positive value towards condoms. Was anybody surprised by this? Because I assigned this article in another class before, so I always like try to reread it and take new notes and then compare my notes. And in both times, I remarked that I was surprised that this was a woman's perspective. Sort of reflective, sort of my bias, perhaps.
Well, if we're assuming that fertility is a socially valuable good, then you'd assume that both men and women would believe that a reduction in fertility caused by condoms mm-hmm. is negative and mm-hmm. associate that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess I was just thinking too that you know they talk about that the women in their samples seemed more affiliated with the West, and the men more affiliated with tradition. And that just struck me as, I would have thought it was the other way around. Yeah.
I'm not that surprised because I would tend to think that women are the ones that are subject to structural violence. Mm-hmm. And offering them an alternative will make them like, okay, there's mm-hmm. an alternative. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, men are like, generally position of power, on a position of power, an alternative will mean lose that position of power. Mm. So I think that's why maybe. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, I kind of agree just because as, I guess from the woman's perspective, they're always the reason why everything's going wrong. So this is kind of like, not your fault kind of thing. Mm. You know, here's mm-hmm. why. I would be more accepting to hearing something that tells me, hey, it's not your fault. You know, you're not the reason why, you know, I'm mm-hmm. a witch. You know what I mean? So, I don't know.
Okay. No, okay. Yeah, Anne.
And I thought it was interesting the way you compared like women to like a more Western perspective because like I maybe this article was just so convincing to me that I played into like sort of like women the analogy that you had up on the previous slide of like women to local mm-hmm. much more than like women to West is mm-hmm. that like although I get that there's a lot of similarities with like how you know we kind of the context we put it in the West, but I also think that like it's much more focused on the local interventions, like locally what you can do mm-hmm. In these very specific instances. And then not again, maybe why I was surprised by my how much I was unsurprised by.
Oh, I understood. I'm with you.
Yeah, I was also just kind of not so surprised that crave for education. It seems, albeit certainly not universal, that seems to be a common thread in a lot of communities, that women, if presented with the option of education, are open to it. And actually, that, especially when we got some of the, what were they called in this article? The women that they that the woman interviewed, informants, I think she called them. I was curious to know if they wanted education sooner, what their other education, what other education they were receiving outside of just sexual reproductive health. Because I was curious as to how they had access to these educational programs anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did a lot of YouTube and Google video searching for to see if there could be any good stories. Mm-hmm. And a few of the women, and I forget, I don't remember in which, but I had it for, Botswana, Uganda, whatever, said, when this group came to town, it was great. I felt empowered and I felt educated, but they came after I'd already been having sex for 3 years.
I guess what was the age range that they were targeting? Was it,
I think it was adolescence, wasn't it?
Yeah, I guess I was
14, 19?
Because a lot of the informants here also said similarly, I really wish they came sooner, this is a little bit late for me. So I'm just curious as to what age range would be appropriate. Because adolescence is what, 13 to 22?
But as a parent of a 7-year-old, talking amongst my other friends who have 7, 8-year-olds, what they're saying now is 9, 10, at least here. Yeah. So, all right, so thank you for those of you who've sort of said, I don't know why you were surprised, because it makes perfect sense to us, that in situations of more oppressive, we can see that in where the women are placing blame. Yes, they understood the biological mechanism of transmission, but they also had dialogues of blame. They were blaming men who oppressed women, engaged in unscrupulous sexual conduct, were careless, and the ones that were abusive boyfriends and husbands. They did acknowledge blame on women for insisting on unprotected sex with husbands. How many of these women actually themselves had unprotected sex with their husbands? It goes back to what we talked about with methodology, that there's reported behavior, there's observed behavior, and you really need to do both. In the one case of the evil hospital nurse.
Is that true?
The evil hospital nurse?
Yeah. Or is that a myth?
My guess was it was a myth.
Yeah, I guess as well, but the way they presented it, I wasn't quite sure.
Yeah, they kept talking as though this was a real person.
Yeah, it's
but...
Well, I think it's a real person.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there was the hospital administration that sort of defended her, but...
Right.
They didn't clear it up at the end, though, as to whether she was charged or...
Yeah.
You know.
Maybe that's not the point, but yeah. Well, no, because that's what I was thinking.
Right.
Well, the point is this woman must have had... perhaps had a level of power that the other women in the sample didn't have or in the community had. I don't know, there's something symbolic about the hospital nurse has to be going on to make her such a central figure. Was the evil hospital nurse white?
I think so. So talking about her children, I got the impression that she was not white.
You know, because you've got these rumors and these stories and these blame happening, in the post-apartheid government. So there's, could have been a racial thing.
Constance Zwane, page 191.
Does it then say, comma, a black South African?
No.
Okay. I don't know. Let's get on to the men's blame. men report in the sample, again, granted it's small, but again, in sort of these sort of types of thick description studies, you're getting themes, you're not getting statistical data. They found more misconceptions about how the disease was spread. And they said it wasn't just ignorance, it was a willful disregard. And the disregard was framed in a political paradigm, less so a biomedical paradigm. These men were more fatalistic, which makes sense. If you are men who are traditionally supposed to be held in positions of power in a patriarchal society, in a situation in which you are not able to exercise any power, you know, on a more global scale, this is a quote full of sort of big terms, but you know, sort of, men express their discontent with persistent social inequity and racism, the fact that the ANC's election promises had not materialized, and the exclusion of the rural from the patrimonial politics of the post-apartheid state. You know, there's sort of a frustration, an impotence, lack of control, which brings out this sort of fatalistic understanding. Because if everything's out of your control, it makes sense that this would be conceptualized as out of your control as well. Interesting, I thought that conspiracy theories were exclusive to men. And there were three, I think, they talked about. And you know, you can kind of see, again, it's not lazy thinking, it makes sense. And this quote, I think, is great. Why would the white man bring them undergrade produce? Undergrade just means you can't sell it in a store, but it's edible. Informant's quote, the farmer doesn't pay his workers well and never transports them to work, but he spends lots of money on petrol in his truck to bring us sweet potatoes. How can he rob his workers but give us sweet potatoes for free? I think he wants to kill us. I mean, granted, extreme final statement there, but with a lack of alternative explanation that makes sense, and the explanation could have even been, the government told me I can't throw these potatoes away anymore, this is a food redistribution program. But again, if that was the case, and there's sort of scant details in the article about why exactly there was this distribution of sweet potatoes, if there even was a distribution of sweet potatoes, could have been a story, done in such an incredibly poor way, you know, for someone to not, I mean, even let's say there was a program and the government said, here's the money, drive these potatoes down to this town, to not have thought, who am I sending to town? Was anyone else familiar with Dr. Basson? Or Basson? He's got a wiki page. He's a nasty man. Look him up. He was the head of the South African Chemical Weapons Program. Tried for murder, like genocide type things. The trial never materialized. And one of the last things he did was he was traveling the world as a consultant for like chemical manufacturers or something. So it had just come out, all of the sort of the things that the South African government had been doing with their chemical weapons program. So he's already sort of a boogeyman culturally. The idea being he, with the help of Americans, invented HIV. And then there was the conspiracy theory of soldiers and beasts. What I think is interesting is, what are some of the consequences of this culture of blame and conspiracy theories? If you are saying that HIV/AIDS has an association with people's behavior of transgressing sexual taboos, and the idea that that does invest infected persons with a degree of responsibility, that leads to greater stigmatization of HIV-positive people. But what the authors both found in their interviews was that there was a lot of excusing of blame happening, though. You know, sort of women were excusing young girls because they were in vulnerable positions, like they couldn't help, you know, their behavior. Men were excused their culpability by focusing on the powerful outsiders. It's the Americans, it's Dr. Basson, it's, you know, the wealthy whites. So those two sort of contradicting factors, they say, leads to greater suspicion and tensions between men and women locally and between the local and the global. So again, Jane, you get to the article and you're like, giant mess. And the key lessons do ring a little hollow. Perhaps we'll explore that next week. An important lesson, I think. Yes.
Just to tie in with the intern luncheon you were talking about, conspiracy theory, so mm-hmm. that they concluded at the end that there was, I think they referred to it as an aura of factuality, so, you know, at least a kernel of truth in terms mm-hmm. of conspiracy theories, when you have a former head of Prairie University trying to develop a bacterium that will kill only black people in South Africa. When that's established as truth, then, you know, there's a greater reason not to trust people in the government or mm-hmm. to wonder what the hell is going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you see this in medical research a lot. You know, people, particularly when you're trying to recruit more African Americans and other minorities in the U.S. into sort of clinical trials, and they often come back with, well, they keep mentioning Tuskegee. And you're like, you know, now you can mention Guatemala. You know, it's like, there is that, you know, it's not unprecedented, which gives a lot more credence to it, you know. It's a shame, but... That's what Jonathan was talking about, James, for the presidential report on the Guatemalan experiments.
Mm-hmm. So I guess in terms of like the lack of lessons, or maybe the lessons learned, but like sort of the lack of solutions presented in this article, I mentioned this a little bit in my post. I thought there were some solutions within the article. They needed to be parsed out a little mm-hmm. bit. I don't know, the one that I mentioned was the quote on page, like, 194, in which the man says, like, totally agree that AIDS is there. But in the hospital, they blame AIDS for every death, and then he goes on to talk about, like, the inappropriate way in which they test for HIV. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that seems, maybe that's a very small point in the greater context, but it seems like such an easy fix to just, like, you know, not reveal, like, to protect confidentiality, to not reveal results in front of mm-hmm. people, to give people the option of, you know, whether it's an opt-out or an opt-in program to make some aspect of it voluntarily. And also him saying that you need to go beyond, well, I mean, he didn't say this, I'm sort of running with his words a little bit, but, like, you need to go beyond just saying, like, here are your results, go live with them, mm-hmm. and just treat people like a human being, because I think what he's saying is right. And I mean, I think everywhere we learn about HIV, stress increases the rate in which, you know, the viral load increases. I have no idea. I don't know anything about HIV. That, like, I would think that, you know, creating measures after the test would improve the climate a lot from the male perspective. So mm-hmm. I don't know. I really like this article.
Okay.
Maybe have to.
No. You have to stop hedging yourself. Yeah. Particularly as a woman in medicine, just...
Well, I know, but it's very intimidating in this room in which you say something and everyone's just like... And you're like, okay, did I not make any sense? Are we just all in agreement or are we all in disagreement?
Right, but we're too tired and hot to disagree.
That's fine. I guess better than hot and bothered, but... Wait, laughter, this is good. Good, I like the nods of encouragement. Thanks, guys.
No, I find myself doing that sometimes too, and it's.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, so I like the fact that you went and sort of figured out how we could parse out lessons, applicable lessons, not just sort of like hard, you know, hard and fast lessons. But you can imagine, I mean, I can see the frustration of having to work hard for them. Does anyone else have any strong feelings one way or the other about the conspiracy theory article?
Well, I was wondering if there were other articles that dealt with, like, that talked about the conspiracy theory aspect in other places, because, especially in Africa, just because of the extreme sort of like social, cultural, racial issues in South Africa, Africa specifically. I feel like that has to play in hugely into why there's so much with conspiracy theory, but I don't know.
There's hundreds of articles.
Okay.
Hundreds.
So that's what I can look for.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that, and like, I don't know if it just wasn't touched on as much in these, just because it's like kind of like a, maybe not more obvious, but seems like a more go-to reason for why conspiracy theories might be so predominant here.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. South Africa does have, I mean, the whole continent has a history of colonization and white-black, bad white-black relations.
Yeah.
South Africa has it perhaps worse. I don't know. So you find these same sort of conspiracy theories across the board.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. And the same way we saw them with Nigeria, you know, and that was just sort of generalized West, pharmaceutical West. Mm-hmm.
I like the personal aspect here, too, in terms of the quotes from various people interviewed. And I think one of them, the guy's interview, was anti-U.S. And added that, you know, he was pretty unimpressed with the attack on Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, I thought that reinforced reasons to be distrustful and, you know, their words. But, you know, I like that. I guess the multiple quotes in the man, which I just thought like it was helpful to depict, you know, like the viewpoints on what was going on the ground there.
Yeah. I think there's nothing can take the place of personal informants and personal stories. Yeah, Jamie.
So I appreciate deeply that a lot of the feelings and beliefs about HIV are a product of systematic disenfranchisement and economic hardship that some of these men in this article are feeling. But am I the only one that at some point feels like you gotta stop doing that? You can't be such a chauvinistic jerk. You can't say, I can't enjoy the candy if the wrapper's still on, or whatever that quote, horrible quote was. Like, come on.
Man up!
Well, like, don't be such a sexist jerk. Like, I mean, we find that morally reprehensible here if somebody behaves like that in the US. And I get that it's the result of disenfranchisement that we don't necessarily have in the US, but like, just like take some responsibility.
I just respond like to that notion. I felt similarly. I felt like I was more forgiving of the older men and less so when they mentioned like how young some of the boys were, and I was like, seriously? Like, you're born after apartheid, like, which, again, isn't their fault because they're taught by some people. Well, personally, again, maybe I shouldn't use the word fault at all. I'll just take that back. But, like, I mean, you're just wondering what the interventions are for this age group, because I feel similarly to you in that, like, especially with the younger generation, it's like, oh, God, like, let's change things.
There's one, I think this was a South African case. It's called Soul Buddies. SOULBUDDZ. And it's South African, there's a soul something or other, and then the Soul Buddies is for the kids. Mm-hmm. And they have a radio program and a TV show. They do weekly episodes. I couldn't find any of the whole episodes. But there is, if you're sort of soul buddies on YouTube, there's a